Good morning and welcome. We're here this morning to hear argument in the case of Red Lobster Restaurants, LLC, Progressive Flooring Services, Inc., and Dwayne Federoff, appellants, and Abigail Frick, appellee. It's a civil transfer case. Transfer has been granted. Counsel for the appellants will argue first. In a counsel table representing the appellants, we have Nick Brunette, and I don't have your name, Catherine Heron. Welcome, Mr. Brunette and Ms. Heron. And representing the appellees at counsel table, we have David Stone. Good morning and welcome, Mr. Stone. As we have been conducting oral arguments, you'll each have about 2 minutes before we may start asking questions. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Brunette.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Rush, fellow justices, counsel. Honesty under oath is required for the fair operation of our judicial system. There must be consequences when the integrity of our system is challenged, and that applies both in state and in federal bankruptcy court. Here, the trial court erred by failing to enter summary judgment in favor of Red Lobster on July 4th of 2022, because plaintiff has admittedly failed to disclose not only this personal injury lawsuit, but another personal injury lawsuit against Menards in her Chapter 13 bankruptcy proceeding. Not only did she fail to disclose it to the bankruptcy court, she also failed to truthfully answer under oath interrogatories asking her specifically whether she had filed.
So I appreciate your protection and sort of caping up for the bankruptcy court here, but how is your client hurt by her mistake?
Well, and that's a great question. And the reason judicial estoppel exists is the integrity of the court system. This is bigger than Red Lobster, no offense to my client. It's bigger than them. It has to do with the integrity of the court system and the fair operation of our system. My client, just like any other client, is entitled to a truthful answer under oath with respect to this bankruptcy. Why that matters, Justice Massa, is because what happens if they don't? They may not be the real party in interest.
Aren't there other tools? I mean, there's perjury, there's contempt, there could be penalties on discovery. Why in our state court system would those not be sufficient? I mean, we use those tools to protect the integrity. Here, you've got the bankruptcy court didn't even care about it. You agree that you're talking about generally, because in this case, the bankruptcy court said, well, whatever. I mean, they didn't want to take the case. They let her do it. The bankruptcy was dismissed. She eventually did report. Where's the harm in this particular case?
Sure.
And who's it to?
Sure. And the harm is to the system. The harm is to the court, the harm is to the integrity
of the system.
But nobody
was harmed because now her bankruptcy was dismissed, so the creditors can come after her if she gets a judgment in this case. Who's actually harmed in this case?
Again, she's received the preliminary benefits of a bankruptcy from the moment of the filing, which includes a laundry list of things that you get as a debtor who files bankruptcy.
She did disclose. Is the timing irrelevant of when she disclosed?
Well, she continued to receive those preliminary benefits throughout the duration that she was hiding this asset. That included, so the people who are harmed remain the creditors. And the reason—
Doesn't your remedy harm the creditors? I mean, she still owes those debts because the bankruptcy has been dismissed. So if she can't recover from your client, doesn't that deprive her creditors of a potential source of repaying the debt?
The remedy doesn't exist in full, and the reason is because you got an automatic stay, right?
I'm asking a different question. Sure. If we rule in your favor, don't we harm the bankruptcy creditors?
If we rule in your favor, you do not harm the bankruptcy creditors in this case at all, because the bankruptcy creditors in this case don't have claims at this point.
Well, but they have claims against her outside of this case. They want her to pay them money. She owes them debts. She doesn't have enough money to do it. If she gets money from your client, if she wins in this lawsuit, she can use some of that money to pay the bankruptcy creditors, right? But if we rule in your favor, that's not a possibility?
Well, I think that's entirely speculative. One of the things that happens when you file bankruptcy is you have to come forward as a creditor. There's possibly innocent people out there who didn't come forward, who weren't entitled to this information.
Put it a different way, the remedy could only harm the creditors. It can't help them, right? The remedy here cannot help the bankruptcy creditors.
The remedy, well, again, you're assuming that there are still bankruptcy creditors that exist. I mean, that is an assumption that's just not in the record. Having additional funds, I don't think at the end of the day is the true benefit to the creditors in the sense of a true bankruptcy proceeding, because the process is designed for her to pay these debts back through a scheduled plan. But to get back to Chief Justice Rush's question, there are other remedies. But to be honest, those remedies are not adequate. I know in Hewley we talk about how the remedy being the 56G motion, right, or the attempt to go back and say, well, if you don't, testify under oath or say something, or you provide a sham affidavit, as that was being described to some extent, there are repercussions. However. The reality is, in practice, 56J doesn't exist. Even I don't know if you've seen a case. I'm unaware of a case that exists out there. And the reason why, in practice, it doesn't exist is because, in reality, if you challenge an affidavit and say it's a sham, the court is inclined, majority of the time, to accept the affidavit. At that point, 56G becomes irrelevant because the court has accepted the affidavit.
We've never had a case on judicial estoppel in this context, have we?
I don't believe so.
All right, let's say we say we're not going to adopt the doctrine of judicial estoppel. Well, talk to me about that.
Well,
maybe just in this context, if the bankruptcy court wants to protect the integrity of the bankruptcy system, they've got rules and regulations and laws that they can enact. If you perjure yourself in the state courts, we've got our own rules. Why?
Sure. And while I would tell you that we would maybe be one of the only two, I think there's maybe one state, West Virginia, I think, maybe, that doesn't have judicial estoppel. I don't think we want to be a state that doesn't adopt the truthfulness of litigants in either jurisdiction. The bankruptcy court is a federal court is just as serious as it is in front of this court or in front of any other trial court. You have to be truthful. So I think that we should adopt a judicial estoppel.
But you want us to adopt it. You want us to imply intent, correct?
No, I don't want you to imply intent at all in this.
Because this seems very much that she did the affidavit saying, "Listen, she's reading it through. I didn't know if this was bankruptcy. She ended up. This was inadvertent. The Court of Appeals. Everyone's finding it inadvertent. How do you win here?"
Sure, and it's fairly easy. I think we win even if you do consider the affidavit, because I think the affidavit itself needs to be struck under Garberry. I think the Court of Appeals' reliance, understand it's vacated, was on Hewley. This court is well aware in Hewley there were no inconsistent statements. Mr. Antonio Hewley never said that the 77 Buick was used for criminal enterprises in federal court and then came into state court and said something else. He never made inconsistent statement. What this court said is that it may be thin, but it was competent. It wasn't contradictory. And that's where Garberry comes in. Garberry has been the precedent here.
But in Garberry, the plaintiff never explained the discrepancy between the deposition and the affidavit. And I find that different than this case.
Well, are you referring to Garberry or are you referring to Ellis or the judicial estoppel cases? Garberry is what I'm referring to is you can't make inconsistent statements in a deposition under oath or any other proceeding and then for purposes of summary judgment say the exact opposite.
Gabriel, it was never explained. The discrepancy between the two were never explained, and that seemed like a much clearer case.
Well, there was a discrepancy in Garberry. Garberry, he said he knew that the road ended in the deposition, and that he said he could not tell where the road ended in his affidavit.
But then he didn't have the other, and we have this. We have the answer in the affidavit. We've got the discrepancy, but then we have the explanation. The third prong of that was never done in that case, explanation.
And here, I don't think you have the explanation. So you have an affidavit put forward in front of you that says, I didn't know that this was an asset of my bankruptcy. The question, the operative question is why? That's what you need to decide good faith. We've met our burden of demonstrating both, one, that there was motive to conceal and that she had knowledge of the claim. They have to come forward at the trial court, the Court of Appeals, in here and tell us what the good faith is. They haven't told you why. Maybe
Counsel, those are all factual questions. It's not clear to me whether the trial judge should be making those factual determinations or whether those should be jury questions. And it looks to me like the Court of Appeals has decided that both ways. There's another case where they decided that that was for the judge to decide. This panel seems to suggest that that's a jury question. Who decides?
Yeah, so, I think it's very clear on the facts of this case and what I stand by, and I stand by the authority on Garberry, because I think it is really important. Because Garberry, to me, is the belt, and 56G is the suspenders. You don't see a lot of those cases. You don't see a lot of people wearing suspenders. But the Garberry case is the belt that provides the protection against sham affidavits. It provides that you can't say one thing under oath and then say something else that's completely contradictory. Otherwise, summary judgment is dead.
So if we disagree about that and we think there's a factual dispute, is it the judge that resolves the factual dispute as to the plaintiff's intent, motive, good faith, or if there's a factual dispute, does a jury decide that?
I don't think there can be, in this particular case, a factual dispute, because what Garberry tells us is we're not going to weigh that evidence. I disagree that there is a dissent in Garberry that talks about we're getting into the weighing of the evidence. I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I think you're not weighing evidence at all. It's saying if you testify under oath, that means something. And we're not going to consider what you say again. That's not saying which one is right.
So you don't believe there can ever be a case where there's a factual dispute about the plaintiff's intent with regard to the nondisclosure of an asset in bankruptcy court?
I do.
And so in one of those cases, is that the judge that decides the factual dispute or the jury?
I think it could be the jury. Okay. It definitely could be the jury. There's no doubt about it. But what I'm saying in this case, the one we're here in front of you, you don't have the why. You don't have the reason why she didn't have this understanding. And it may very well be that, you know, someone didn't tell her. Whatever the reason is, that's the reason you need to find good faith. And I realize I've tried to reserve 5 minutes. I'm a little over that, so I'll sit down and come back up.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll look forward to hearing from you again on rebuttal. Mr. Stone.
Judicial estoppel was first applied in 1857 in a Tennessee case, Hamilton versus Zimmerman. It adopted what has been called an absolute rule under which any time a person made a statement, he could not later contradict it. As far as I can tell, only Tennessee is the only state that follows the absolute rule. Red Lobster position requires this state to adopt an absolute rule when any time a party makes an inconsistent statement, he can't later correct it or show why they made the mistake. As covered in Wright and Miller in the cited materials, mistakes are sometimes due to mistake or inadvertence. Red Lobster wants to say no mistakes are permissible. Red Lobster wants to deny courts any discretion to determine how to respond to discovery mistakes. Discovery sanctions are normally under the civil equivalent of let the punishment fit the crime. Red Lobster wants no discretion. If you make a mistake, you're out of the case. The U.S. Supreme Court in Maine and New Hampshire said, we do not question that it may be appropriate to resist application of judicial estoppel when a party's prior position was based on inadvertence or mistake. Red Lobster position in the strict accord of the exceptions to judicial estoppel for honest mistake or inadvertence. Both the Seventh Circuit and Indiana courts have routinely found that the application of judicial estoppel is in the equitable discretion of the court. The most recent state case was in October 27th this year, WHLOT versus Bolt. The premise of judicial estoppel is that absent a good explanation, a party should not be permitted to gain an advantage by litigating on one theory and thereafter pursuing an incompatible theory in subsequent litigation. However, the doctrine only applies when a litigant has made an intentional misrepresentation, so the litigant's bad faith intent is dispositive of his application. Red Lobster claims how the plaintiff gained advantage from the bankruptcy. She was taking take-home pay of $2,118 with $491 for taxes, giving her take-home was $1,627. She was to pay $1,350 for 60 months on total debts of $130,884. She was paying more under the plan than unsecured creditors could get by garnishment. The Menard suit was not designated by Red Lobster to the trial court as support for its summary judgment motion. This court and the Court of Appeals often held that you can only rely on things designated on summary judgment. By not designating it, the plaintiff was denied the opportunity to designate her discovery response, saying that she did disclose the Menard suit. In thousands of cases, this court and the Court of Appeals have held that credibility questions can't be decided only on the basis of a transcript. Red Lobster wants the credibility of whether or not she made an honest mistake decided just on the basis of what she said.
Mr. Stone, do you agree that Mrs. Frick had a duty to disclose her lawsuit to the bankruptcy court?
No, I don't.
Okay, tell me what your authority is for that.
Nothing in the Chapter 13 plan she filed gave any duty to disclose subsequent claims. In fact, there's a section attached to that petition, rights and responsibility of Chapter 13 debtors and their attorneys.
Do you have any case law to support that? The Seventh Circuit has held that the debtor does have a duty to disclose.
But I also think you have to go to the fact that there was no uniform Chapter 13 form at the time she filed her bankruptcy petition. In this case, the form attached to her petition said, contact the attorney promptly if the debtor acquires any property after petition is filed. Such property might include, as not limited to, personal injury proceeds, inheritances, lottery winnings, etc. No one could read that and not think that did not cover potential claims of personal injury.
Counsel, when the bankruptcy was dismissed, were some of the debts still outstanding?
Yes. It was dismissed after only 2 or 3 years of payments on it, so she had nowhere near the $130,000 paid off.
And then you mentioned how we deal with credibility disputes. Do you agree that if this case were to go to trial, that opposing counsel can confront your client on the stand with these multiple statements and inquire as to any alleged discrepancies?
Yes, they could use that to try and impeach her, yes. Even though she was not required to do so, she did file an amendment to her bankruptcy case, which listed her claim against Red Lobster potential asset. That's not the act of a person seeking to manipulate the judicial system. The case was dismissed for not keeping up payments. The trustee did not take over the personal injury case. It was not converted to a Chapter 7 case. When the case is dismissed, unadministered assets revert to the debtor. That gave the plaintiff standing to maintain her action. In Hamey versus Brumley, 659 Northeast 2nd, 1021, this court had a number of Chapter 7 cases and held that the debtor did have standing to file the case, but was not the real party in interest. But they could amend the complaint to name the trustee. In this case, there is no trustee to be named. She's the real party in interest, and she has standing to pursue the case.
Any other questions?
None here.
Questions? Counsel, anything further?
Nothing.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. I do want to hit the duty to disclose. I think that is in Ray Wheeler, we cite in our material, not only in Chapter 13 bankruptcy, is there an ongoing obligation throughout that entire process to disclose actual claims, but any potential claims. I think the language that we've cited in our briefing, obviously, the bankruptcy goes through great pains to make sure that debtors understand that these are assets of the bankruptcy estate. Ms. Fricke went through a Chapter 341 bankruptcy under oath examination by Ms. Delaney in her Chapter 13 bankruptcy, where this information is all conveyed to the debtor. So to say she understood that under oath in the bankruptcy proceeding, and then to come into state court and say, I didn't understand that that was an asset. Well, you told a federal district court or federal bankruptcy court that you did.
Mr. Brunette, did her disclosure, and in particular the timing of the disclosure, in any way technically violate the bankruptcy law? My impression is she files it, the claim doesn't exist. She's part of the the plan that goes on, and then this incident that's at issue in your case happens some 2 years later. She eventually does disclose. Is there anything about the timing of that that's a violation of bankruptcy law?
So yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, all the materials she signed under the penalty of perjury, including imprisonment, give her a continuing obligation to disclose assets. So yes, it violated those bankruptcy obligations.
When did she have to do it? What was her?
Well, and that's a interesting question, because there isn't a specific drop dead deadline. However, there have been courts that there's the Cannon Stokes case. It's a Judge Easterbrook wrote, which is a little bit scathing, but he basically demands that it immediately be turned over. If you win the lottery, if you have a pending bankruptcy, he doesn't think that you should have to wait at all. So, but I understand the premise of your question, because that is a question. When is the duty then arise to report it? I do think from here, this occurred on December 31st of 2019. We didn't move for summary judgment until 2021. So there's 18 months of at least time where this is actively going on that she failed to disclose, which we think.
But doesn't that go to Justice Moulter's question? Is that it seems to me that comes up, and that's, you know, that's ripe for cross-examination in the context of your case. How do you do this? But I'm trying to figure out if this was a violation of the bankruptcy code because she did it too late.
Sure. And to answer your question, I guess I don't think there's any inherent benefit to the creditors by allowing her. There's no obligation currently that she has to pay those creditors anything. She may owe them money, but there's no obligation that she has whatsoever, like she did in bankruptcy, to pay them. So the benefit that she obtained from that bankruptcy proceeding took place. But in the materials that we've cited in the appellate brief, there is that ongoing and continuing duty, and we've cited to those as to when you have to continually update the trustee as to this information, and the trustee must, you know, be reported of this information, which it technically, again, we don't get to know, because there's no testimony from the trustee as to why this was dismissed. It looks like it was dismissed for non-payment. It had nothing to do with this claim.
Counsel, is another route to the same destination where you're trying to get, if this was an intentional misrepresentation in your case, would that mean Trial Rule 37 would allow the trial court to impose a discovery sanction that might include dismissing the lawsuit or dismissing the claim?
Yeah, I do think Trial 37 comes into play, and for intentional misconduct. But like I said, proving that someone wasn't mistaken or isn't mistaken is nearly impossible under the 56G standard. And that's the reality in practice, is that proving that there was bad faith, our clients shouldn't have to go to trial to prove that, when the evidence is clear that you said one thing under oath and you're saying something now. That is the ripe reason that Garberry exists, to say, hey, in these situations, you can't say two different things in front of two different courts and get to the jury. That's where the judge comes in. That's all we've asked of the trial court, to say, unfortunately, you made representations to counsel, you made representations to the bankruptcy court, you're making different ones here, but you're not entitled to do that. Thank you.
Counsel, your time is not quite up. I have
sure.
One more question.
Sure,
I can't resist. The transfer briefing didn't focus on standing, but the Court of Appeals briefing did. As I think of standing, there are at least two requirements: causation and injury, potentially a third, redressability. Which of those criteria wasn't met here, or is there a criteria I'm not thinking of, or I should say
element? So I would stand on our briefing with respect to standing. I do think standing for us is somewhat of a challenge. However, I think the artful issue that happens is, because this occurred during the pendency of the Chapter 13 bankruptcy, by definition under the bankruptcy code, it is an asset of the estate. And unless you get permission from the bankruptcy trustee to proceed, it didn't exist. So she never took that affirmative step, and then it's dismissed. So you essentially have this outlier out there where this is technically still an asset, and the question becomes, did that revert to her? What happens to that property that was a part of the Chapter 13 estate? We've argued it in the brief. Again, I think our stronger argument is that this affidavit should have been struck under Garberry, and if it's struck, judicial estoppel applies both under Ellis and in Upton. And I think judicial estoppel is an important doctrine, so people testify truthfully in both federal court, state court, any court. Thank you.
Okay. Counsel, thank you. We appreciate your arguments today. We will be discussing the case and issuing an opinion in due course, and that concludes the oral argument.